The Negro in Illinois was a book project that came out of FDR's Works Progress Administration in the 1930s. Chicago-based African-Americans such as novelists Richard Wright and Frank Yerby and dancer and choreographer Catherine Dunham were hired to research and write about Illinois black history from the beginnings of slavery to the Great Migration of the 20th century. But World War II caused the book's publication to be sidelined until now. I'm Jim Meadows, and today on Focus, we'll talk with Brian Dolinar, the editor of the first-ever edition of The Negro in Illinois, about the history it recounts and the history it made. Focus continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Today's program is about the rediscovery, maybe I could say the reconstructing, of a lost book on black history. The book is The Negro in Illinois. It was conceived as part of President Franklin Roosevelt's Federal Writers Project. The book brought together several notable Chicago-based African-American writers and artists for an ambitious project, recording down the long-neglected history of African-Americans in the state of Illinois. But World War II brought the Federal Writers Project to an end before The Negro in Illinois could be published. Some of the material has been used for other works, but The Negro in Illinois itself remained unpublished until now. The Negro in Illinois, the WPA Papers, was published last year by the University of Illinois Press. And the book's editor is my guest today on Focus, Dr. Brian Dolinar. He's a scholar of African-American history. He's currently teaching history at the University of Illinois. He's also the author of The Black Cultural Front, Black Writers and Artists of the Depression Generation, published by University Press, University Press of Mississippi. And Brian, welcome to Focus.
Hi, Jim. Happy to be here. Thanks.
Now, I understand you spent like about a decade tracking down the papers and going through them related to this project and editing the book into its final form. Was The Negro in Illinois never completed? I mean, was there never a completed manuscript back during the day of the Federal Writers Project, or was that manuscript lost?
Well, according to letters I was able to find between the two chief supervisors, the editor of the project, Arna Bontomp and Jack Conroy, letters between them say that the book was finished and they were sending it out to editors. They sent it off to their literary agent, who was giving it to publishers, and it received at least one rejection letter. There was, despite the interest in black novels, like Richard Wright's novels in the 40s and other works, they couldn't get this book published in the early 40s. So it sat in the archives for some 70 years, and it was a great value to scholars, but it was never published.
And I'm just wondering, was there a finished book, everything with an index in the back and that sort of thing, waiting to go, or were you only able to find the papers that were used to assemble it, the original manuscripts, the original research notes, and any notes about the structure of the book?
Yeah, we have an outline for the book that includes 29 chapters. We have copies of the chapters, the titles and everything. There was a bibliography prepared. There's no introduction, no conclusion that we were able to find, but there is, according to the letters, they said that the manuscript was finished. And we have some indication that they were sending it out. This is the summer of 1942. They were sending it out to publishers. The papers then have a kind of afterlife. When the project was shut down, the papers sat in a basement of a library for a couple decades, and the authors themselves that were sending the chapters back and forth and rewriting some of the material for another book that later came out, a book called They Seek a City, published in 1945 by Bontomp and Conroy. And in the process of writing that 1945 book, they were sharing these chapters back and forth. And in the process, one-third of the papers were lost.
Just lost.
Still lost
today?
Well, most of the papers were left in Chicago with Vivian G. Harsh. She was a librarian at the what was then the Hall Branch Library at Michigan of 48th, which is still there on the south side. And she had her own collection, which became the Harsh Research Collection, as it's known today. And the papers were handed over to Vivian G. Harsh. She held on to them. So there's today about 50 boxes of materials left behind, and that's what I found when I stumbled across the papers. But when I came across them, one-third of the chapters were missing, so I had to go on a kind of treasure hunt to try to track down these missing chapters. And after visiting Newberry up in Chicago, where Jack Conroy's papers are, after going to Springfield, the state office for the Illinois Writers Project, after going to D.C., the Federal Writers Project papers are held there, I had to go to Syracuse, where Arna Bontomp's papers are in New York, and finally I found the last three chapters that I had been looking for, and finally we had all the 29 chapters back together again for the first time.
It's really a lot of legwork to get this book put back together again.
Right.
Well, if you have questions about the Negro in Illinois and also the history that this book recounts, you can give us a call and talk to Brian. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL. You can also send an email to will-talk@illinois.edu. I was thinking that perhaps this is a good time to go back and take a look at what the Federal Writers Project was, because there's certainly nothing like that coming out of the federal government today, essentially as part of the New Deal programs that FDR had in the 1930s. Unemployed writers were hired to write books.
Right, yeah, and this was a time of Roosevelt's New Deal in the 1930s. The economic situation was so dire. Mass unemployment, joblessness, people are standing in food lines. It's a sign of how desperate things were back in the 30s that they created such an ambitious program. The WPA put writers back to work, but it was also, people are probably more familiar with, the roads built, the buildings that were constructed. Most notably here in town, we have the Student Union, a WPA project built at the University of Illinois here by WPA workers. Lakeshore Drive in Chicago, one of the most beautiful drives in the country, built by WPA workers. But additionally, they were also putting writers and artists back to work. Folks might have seen murals in post office before. Those were a lot of them done by WPA artists. As well, they were putting writers to work for the first time, really trying to tell a comprehensive national story. And so state by state, they set up these writers' projects, and they had as their purpose writing state guidebooks, which you can now find in used bookstores.
As a matter of fact, I have a copy of the Illinois WPA guidebook when it was, I guess someone put out a new edition of it in the 1970s or 80s.
Right, yeah, they have been kind of rediscovered a few years back and were re-released. There was one state by state, and the one here for Illinois is a case in point, that when these first came out, they were all white writers on the project telling largely white history. So if you look at the state guidebook for Illinois, out of 600 pages, it's a long manuscript, 600 pages, there's 6 pages dedicated to African Americans.
What does the WPA Illinois guide say about African Americans?
Well, it says very little. It highlights meatpacking workers, a few small black towns that had existed, one of the original black towns, Brooklyn, Illinois. A few of these things are mentioned, but very little. So there was a part of a nationwide effort to get African Americans written into these state guidebooks and to get black authors on the WPA. And this was a project headed up by professors at Howard University in Washington, D.C., who pressured the Roosevelt administration. It's like in the early days of what's now known as the unofficial black cabinet. They were pressuring the Roosevelt administration for more blacks on the WPA. And in general, they were recording numbers that were showing that of New Deal benefits in whatever form, whatever kind of relief was being offered in the early 30s, African Americans were disproportionately failing to receive the kind of relief that white workers were. So there was an effort to try to get more black relief, and one of the ways was try to get somebody appointed and as a head of Negro Affairs, and they selected Sterling Brown, who was a literature professor at Howard, had published a well-known book of poetry called Southern Road, and Sterling Brown still wrote wonderful poetry for his day, and also a critic. And he headed up a national project as head of Negro Affairs to establish 17 different black projects focused on collecting black history, state by well, it wasn't necessarily all state by state. There was there weren't 50 of them. There were at least 17, and some folks might have heard of the collection of ex-slave narratives in the 1930s. This had been started in the late 20s, but it was picked up and formalized by WPA workers who helped to really bolster this massive project of collecting narratives of ex-slaves who were, by the 1930s, passing on. This is about 50 years after or more past slavery. So it was urgency in the 1930s to collect these ex-slave narratives, and they were published in a book called Drums and Shadows, and now there's some 2,000 of these ex-slave narratives that are held at the Library of Congress. So there were other projects. There was one that was, the only one that was published in the early 40s was the Negro in Virginia that was released. And this inspired folks in Chicago to redouble their efforts and produce The Negro in Illinois. They sped up their efforts, but again, it was never published.
And didn't really get started. It got started in the late 1930s.
It got started in 1935. Richard Wright, the novelist, author of Native Son and Black Boy, Richard Wright was hired on the project. He was probably one of the first black writers to be hired onto the project in Illinois in late 1935. Richard Wright was working on the WPA.
The names that struck that came out to me: Richard Wright, Frank Yerby, who wrote a lot of historical novels, and I was struck that while Negro in Illinois was still percolating, Richard Wright's Native Son was published, and
really
to great acclaim.
Right.
Frank Yerby himself was actually a very commercially successful novelist.
Yeah, Frank Yerby's known for being the first black author to make $1 million.
That's something to note. I was struck to see Catherine Dunham, because I remember hearing Catherine Dunham in the news at the end of her life during efforts to save her school in East St. Louis.
That's right.
And I had not known about her as a writer, but she was that as well.
Yeah, she was an anthropologist. She came out of both Northwestern and University of Chicago in the 30s. She was a student of Melville Herskovitz, a well-known anthropologist. And she went to Haiti and did field work in Haiti, where she got into voodoo and adapted a lot of these, the dance that she saw in Haiti for her later dancing style, the whole Dunham technique that she developed. And Catherine Dunham went to work on the WPA in about 1938. It was an interesting project, and this is where she actually crossed paths with Frank Yerby. There was a project here in 1938 to conduct a study of what were then called black cults and storefront churches. These were black people coming up during the black migration, coming to Chicago and founding their own small congregations in storefronts, founding their own faiths, a kind of amalgam of Christianity and Islam oftentimes. And so out of this period, you get things like Noble Du Ali's Morris Science Temple. You get things like the Nation of Islam. They were conducting what I believe to be one of the first studies of the Nation of Islam
now,
in Chicago.
Now, is that in the Negro in Illinois?
Some of that material made it in a chapter called What is Africa to Me? A chapter on black nationalism. And as well, Dunham records in her memoirs a meeting Elijah Muhammad and recalls when they first tried to send out WPA workers, and these were some of them, white workers, black and white workers, were working side by side in the Chicago offices. They would send white workers out to the South Side to try to collect these stories of what was going on in these small black churches. And the white workers didn't get too far, as you can imagine. So they start sending and hiring black workers like Frank Yerby to go collect these stories. So we have actually documentation of Frank Yerby and others, black WPA workers, going in these very small, obscure, black congregations in the 1930s and collecting these firsthand accounts, which we don't have anywhere else, of what's going on behind those doors.
That's one thing that strikes me here. There's the writing of this book, and then there's the research that went into this book, and just thinking of the nature of Black history at the time and where it was neglected by certainly by the mainstream of historians, that everything had to be pretty much done in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the part where we're going into the past and trying to find papers and documentation, that must have been a great challenge.
Yeah, but this was a part of a whole effort in the 1920s and 1930s, in particular in Chicago, where there's a very, you know, learned and active and bustling Black middle class that has already been in Chicago for a couple generations. But in the 1920s and 30s, we see emergence of something we call now the Chicago Renaissance.
Now, I wanted to ask about that, because certainly I've heard of the Harlem Renaissance in the 1920s, but the Black Chicago Renaissance is something separate and a little later, I take it, than the Harlem Renaissance.
Right. So if the Harlem Renaissance took place during the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, the Jazz Age, the Chicago Renaissance came about during the Depression, the following decade, the 1930s. And there's important distinctions between the two movements. While they're both literary, artistic, cultural movements, the 1920s was they had the idea of getting civil rights through copyright. Publishing books would allow people to advance. And in the 30s, there was a different kind of attitude. There was a belief that in the 1920s, people sat around and sipped tea and had discussions, but were disconnected from what people out in the streets were experiencing. And in the 1930s, this great social movements of the time, writers were in the streets alongside those people marching out for their rights. And so there was a kind of a great deal of collaboration and cross-fertilization of the social political movements of the 1930s and the writers and the artworks coming out of the movement among Black people on the South Side. So as Arne Bontemp said, this was a movement without finger bowls. All right, this was not a tea party.
Before we go further, just want to remind folks that you're listening to Focus. And my guest today is Brian Dolinar. He's the editor of The Negro in Illinois, a book that waited 72 years to be published, but it's out now from the University of Illinois Press. Call in your questions for Brian at 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL, or send an email to will-talk@illinois.edu. And it sounds like a more activist nature to the Chicago Renaissance. One thing that I had read about the Harlem Renaissance was it was sort of a case where writers had patrons, and that's how they were able to keep going economically. And once the Depression hit, then the patrons weren't so flush with money, and that was pretty much the decline and end of the Harlem Renaissance. What kept the writers of the Chicago Renaissance going in the Depression?
Yeah, indeed, it was the WPA. So Black writers were, you know, not being published in mainstream journals, white newspapers. Their books were not being picked up by white publishers. So Black writers at this time otherwise had to, you could publish in the Black press, the small Black journals, but more so they were getting hired on by the WPA. And so this was a great boon to Black writers struggling to survive in the 1930s. Otherwise, they would have been sweeping floors, cleaning up after white folks. And so this was a great boon to writers and produced all this wonderful material. Now, again, they were very much in touch with what was going on the ground. So there was other energies in the late 20s and early 30s to bring more attention to Black history. And I highlight in the book a group called the National Memorial Society. They were called the National DuSable Memorial Society is what they were called. And they were founded by a woman named Annie Oliver in 1928. This was a group at its height, a group of about 300 women, largely women, to bring attention to the Black founder of Chicago, the first non-native settler of Chicago, Jean-Baptiste Point du Sable.
And I'm wondering if there's any connection with that organization back then and the DuSable Museum of today.
Exactly, very much so. And the reason we have things like the DuSable Museum or DuSable High School on the South Side is because of these women trying to bring attention and recognition to this black founder of Chicago. So Margaret Burroughs, who founded the DuSable Museum, was very much a part of these movements in the 1930s.
And this book, The Negro in Illinois, starts with a chapter about DuSable.
Right. It starts with a chapter called First the French. And the French were in these northern parts here. They had come through Canada, through the lakes, and come down to settle in Illinois. And DuSable was a trader between the French and the Native Americans, the few British and increasing number of Americans here. And he had a cabin that was there at the where the river meets the lake, as the natives said, and as the native Potawatomi would say in this parts, the first white man in these parts was colored. And this was Jean-Baptiste Point DuSable. He had a cabin, a fairly large property estate that was very well established. He was one of the wealthiest individuals around here, and left his mark. We do have some records of his presence here, and as the first non-native settler of these parts.
And I know that he was active in other parts of Illinois. There's a statue of DuSable in Peoria, I know, because they're understanding that he had done business there and had owned land in Peoria at one point. So I know there's out on the south side of Peoria, mm-hmm. Preston Jackson, who's done some work here in Champaign-Urbana, has a statue of him there.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. Well, DuSable was eventually moved west of the Mississippi. He's buried over in St. Charles on the west side of St. Louis. It's suggested because of the growing number of Americans in these parts, he was forced west. Because he had sided with the French, he was unliked by the Americans in these parts. But DuSable was a crucial figure, and there was a whole movement to dig up his name here in the late 20s and 30s that, you know, the founders of Chicago, the city leaders, didn't want to recognize DuSable as being the original founder. So women, as part of this National DuSable Memorial Society, had heard about the 1933 World's Fair that was going to be in Chicago, and so they wanted to get a cabin dedicated to DuSable. So they pressured city leaders and eventually were able to get a small cabin constructed. And we reprint the photo in the book of about 50 women standing out in front of this cabin that had been at the 1933 World's Fair. And so when the WPA was started and folks were certainly starting to hear about this legend of DuSable, this is then formalized and put into print by these WPA writers who are interviewing women with the National DuSable Memorial Society. They do two interviews with Annie Oliver and use some of her pamphlets, and so are able to put in writing for the first time the record of this black founder of Chicago.
And I can imagine this must have been important to have somebody who was a man of means. DuSable was definitely in charge of his life, doing business, owning land, and knowing that a good deal of the history of the Negro in Illinois for the first few centuries was going to be the history of slaves, it's important to have someone like DuSable in there.
Right. And DuSable was never a slave. There's never a record of him being a slave. He was a free individual. And so he establishes a kind of history of black entrepreneurialism in Chicago that leads up to figures like John Jones, who before and after the Civil War is advocating for African Americans and abolition of the black laws that existed at the time, prohibiting blacks from voting, from testifying in court. And there's other more contemporary entrepreneurs who are founding banks, insurance companies in Chicago in the 1930s. And DuSable became an important predecessor for them. So there's things like the Binga Bank that is established in the 1930s. This is a black-owned bank that's very alive and well in the 1930s. And Binga eventually loses his bank due to the Depression in the late 30s. And Binga as well shows up in the book.
Well, I want to take a short break right now, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with Brian Dolinar about The Negro in Illinois, the book on African-American history in the state, written by African-Americans, plus one white author. We can get into Mr. Conroy in a moment, for the Federal Writers Project, finally published last year. This is Focus on WILL. Welcome back to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Brian Dolinar is our guest today. He's the editor of The Negro in Illinois, the WPA Papers, published by the University of Illinois Press. It's available in hardback and as an e-book. And Brian Dolinar will be talking about The Negro in Illinois this Saturday afternoon at 2. That's at the Urbana Free Library. Copies of the book will be available for sale. There'll also be a display on local African-American history presented by the Champaign County Archives. That's this Saturday at 2 at the Urbana Free Library. Remember, your questions are welcome. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address, will-talk, that's W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. When I think of Illinois, you know, Illinois, land of Lincoln, certainly technically a free state, certainly by the time of the Civil War, but for how long was slavery a reality in Illinois? It seems to have existed to some extent in Illinois even after statehood was granted.
Right. Slavery was practiced in southern Illinois, and particularly in the coal fields way down in southern Illinois. And writers are oftentimes trying to, the WPA writers, were trying to mesh up this contradiction that on the books, at least, this was to be a free state. And yet slavery was still practiced in the South. Segregation was quite prominent in the schools throughout southern Illinois, downstate. Segregation was quite prominent, and there's a chapter where segregation in the schools in Champaign is noted by WPA authors. Segregation as early as 1870 in the schools in Champaign, and so there's these black laws that are on the books as well, prohibiting blacks. And while slavery is mentioned in the book, the authors at this point is a kind of critical turn, I think, in the 1930s. When African-American writers and historians are focusing less on this slave past and constructing this history of freedom, that, and this is written in the book, that there's a sense that African-Americans in the Depression, and they're writing backwards into history, that African-Americans, they say, never the docile slave struck out boldly for freedom. So there's a sense that there's a new day in the 1930s, a new kind of energy, a new activism that writers in writing this book are trying to write themselves into the history books in a whole new light, okay? That African-Americans that African-American history is not about slavery, but about this constant challenging of slavery, constant challenging of the black codes like John Jones does, constantly challenging the absence of African-Americans in history or in world's fairs. So at 1893, when Ida B. Wells and Frederick Douglass and others all meet in Chicago for the World's Fair, they are challenging, where are the presence of African-Americans at the World's Fair? And they produce a pamphlet challenging their absence there. And again, the WPA Project was black writers challenging their absence in these state guidebooks. So it's a history of a real struggle and defiance of the odds.
And so the book, The Negro in Illinois, instead of not just talking about the fact that there was slavery, but is that there was resistance to slavery, and it manages to record a lot of that, and I don't know how far back it goes.
Well, the Underground Railroad was the most visible sign, although somewhat invisible in its day, of resistance, and Chicago, before the Civil War, was known as a sinkhole of abolition. This was one of the main routes.
That's not how the abolitionists would term it, I take it. Some other people might have said sinkhole.
Right, pejoratively, yeah. And so the Underground Railroad was very vibrant. People were coming in through southern Illinois via the rivers that converged. They're coming up the Mississippi. They're entering towns like Cairo, Illinois, and coming up the Mississippi, catching a train or two, headed
to Chicago. And knowing that southern Illinois wasn't a safe haven for them.
Indeed. It was hostile territory just a few steps from the south, yeah. So there was a Halliday Hotel in Cairo that had a basement that there were these kind of rooms that were designated to hold runaway slaves. And the Halliday Hotel existed for some 100 years and was taking in runaway slaves and transporting them up north. So there was a very vibrant and active Underground Railroad among white abolitionists as well, black abolitionists like John Jones and others who are absolutely fighting slavery.
And I'm wondering, in terms of documenting this, where did the writers and researchers of the Negro in Illinois go to find out this piece of history?
Yeah, they were. They had WPA offices set up all throughout the state, so they would send requests, send letters downstate. There's a McDonough County where they are sending letters down and digging up these books. And so they'll ask people to send books or articles from these offices downstate, send them up to Chicago, and they were using these in writing the history. There were some cases where they were getting things out of the Illinois Historical Society maintains a journal, and so they were digging up old articles out of these journals. They had a whole fleet of these unemployed writers, workers that they were putting to work, going out to collect these old newspaper articles, collect these old journal articles, and they were amassing all this information. So actually what ends up in the book is just a small sliver of what's in the some 50 boxes that sit up in Chicago at the Harsh Collection.
So the papers in the Harsh Collection for historians offer even more primary material than comes through in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully the book will point people to go visit the Harsh Collection, which is really a stellar collection. And it's been growing by leaps and bounds, so that they have now papers for the Chicago Defender, for example, boxes and boxes of material. So the Harsh Collection, since it was founded in the 1930s, again, part of all these upsurge of energies, the Harsh Collection was founded in the 1930s as a special collection to hold on to all these materials and to start collecting these formally. As we know, in order to write these histories, we got to have the archives first.
There was one aspect I was thinking, because yesterday was Abraham Lincoln's birthday, comes to mind, and I think you mentioned it earlier in the program. Abraham Lincoln's barber in Springfield was a black man from Haiti.
Right, yeah, this is the story of Billy the Barber, William de Fleurville, who was Lincoln's barber. And, you know, I saw the new Spielberg movie about Lincoln, and it's mentioned in the movie. There's an opening scene where some black characters mention Lincoln's hair being kinky, or later in the movie when Lincoln tells some black characters that he really doesn't know their people. And this was quite contrary to the facts that Lincoln frequented the barbershop of William de Fleurville. He picked up clients there. He frequently told yarns, these stories that he would tell there, and keep up on the local politics in Springfield and the state by hanging out at de Fleurville's barbershop. And in fact, when de Fleurville dies, the newspapers, local newspapers, say, and this is quoted in the book, that only two men really knew Lincoln best. One was his law partner. The other one was William de Fleurville, his barber. De Fleurville, also from Haiti, must have told stories and some of the history of Haiti to Lincoln and give him a kind of different picture of Haiti. So that, keep in mind, this is Haiti of the Haitian Revolution, of Toussaint Louverture, who rebelled against the French, led a slave uprising. And so Haiti was this troubled island here for now about, you know, some, you know, over 50 years by Lincoln's time. And so the U.S. had never opened up any kind of diplomatic relationships with Haiti until Lincoln Lincoln was the first to recognize Haiti and grant diplomacy. And it's suggested that it's because of his relationship to William de Fleurville and de Fleurville's stories of Haiti that Lincoln was able to acknowledge Haiti.
I've seen a lot of back and forth about exactly how Abraham Lincoln regarded black people and the rights they had in society, or how that may have evolved over the course of his life. What do the people writing The Negro in Illinois say about Lincoln in that regard?
Yeah, well, one of the whole chapters is dedicated to nationalism and the whole Back to Africa movement. But few people know that Lincoln, as they write in the book, had supported colonization, and there was something called the American Colonization Society at the time. And these were largely white folks advocating to send black people back to Africa. And Lincoln didn't believe that black and white races could coexist. He thought the best thing for both was to send black folks back to Africa. And he supported colonization. But now, Lincoln evolves over time. As the writers note, he had to be all things to all men. So he did become somewhat more complex as he evolved.
Now, I think it's the What is Africa to Me chapter that you mentioned earlier that discusses to some extent the Back to Africa movement, which existed among white people, maybe for their convenience, but also existed among some black people as well.
Sure, and Marcus Garvey is the most notable exponent of the Back to Africa movement. Garvey, who had been to Chicago several times, but came for the last time in 1920, the authors note, that Garvey's well noted during the Harlem Renaissance, had numerous speeches in Harlem, but came to Chicago in 1920 for the last time and had a run-in with Robert S. Abbott, the founder of the Chicago Defender, the notable black newspaper founded in 1905. And Garvey and his own newspaper, the Negro World, was excoriating Robert Abbott and other black leaders, as he called them, as being misleaders, and denounced them. Abbott, operating his own newspapers, then countered and said that Garvey was a fake and he was selling off these false papers for this believed black star line to exist. And so Garvey comes for the first for his last time in 1920. He appears at the 8th Regiment Armory. This is the armory that's still around on the South Side. Garvey comes to give a speech at the army, gives a rousing speech, and afterwards is quickly grabbed by the police and whisked off to jail for selling stock in this Black Star line. He makes bail and leaves the state. Garvey never returns again to Chicago.
Hmm. We are talking about The Negro in Illinois, the WPA papers. Its editor is Brian Dolinar, who teaches history at the University of Illinois, and he'll be talking about the book this Saturday at 2 at the Urbana Free Library. Still time for your questions. Call us at 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL, and you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Now, the people at the top of the chain, I guess, the editors at the time and the people who did a lot of the actual final writing of The Negro in Illinois, can you tell me about them, about Arna Bontemp and Jack Conroy?
Arna Bontemp and Jack Conroy. Now, Bontemp was best friends with Langston Hughes, and there's a whole book of letters between them, a fascinating collection of letters. And Bontemp had started out as a poet during the Harlem Renaissance, won several of those famous awards from Opportunity and Crisis newspapers, and he was making a name for himself. He still had a hard time finding a job, though, so he would hold a teaching job for a few years, bounce around here and there from New Orleans to St. Louis to California, and he eventually ended up in Chicago. In 1935, he came to do graduate work at the University of Chicago, first as an English major, and then later figured out that he could make a living more likely as a librarian, and he later went on, moved to become the head librarian at Fisk University in Nashville when he left Chicago. But while he was here, he worked on the WPA, and He ran into, I think it was Langston Hughes who introduced him to Jack Conroy. Jack Conroy was a white proletarian writer, as they were known in their day. He was a working class writer. He would work in the coal mines in central Missouri by day and by night, write short stories and poetry. He ran a couple little radical little magazines in the 20s and 30s. And Conroy himself had developed a whole network of working class writers, both black and white. So he knew Nelson Algren in Chicago, a famous writer. He was one of the first to publish Richard Wright in his early poetry. So Conroy had worked on the Writers Project in Missouri in St. Louis, got ran out of town for union activity, and ended up with his help, with help of Nelson Algren in Chicago. And Conroy first went to the work on the project telling industrial tales. He would go around to factories, and he was a coal miner's son. And so he had this kind of working class identity, and he had this Irish background. He loved to collect stories and folklore and the language that workers used. He loved to collect this and write this down and use this as inspiration for his stories and his and later his novels. So these two men are introduced by Langston Hughes. Both are working on the WPA, seeing one another frequently. They start to work on a children's novel that was based on one of these industrial tales. I think it's the one where there's a dog who is said to be able to run faster than a train. And it's this children's story that they eventually turn into a children's book.
You know, besides the fact that one's black and one's white, are they different people, or are they
very much so, very much so? Arne Bontemps is a kind of middle class, family man, dedicated to his wife, raising his children, working most of his life, and trying to eke out some time to write here and there. Avoided politics for the most part, unlike his friend Langston Hughes. Jack Conroy, very much a leftist figure. Associated with the Communist Party, member of the Communist Party, and Conroy was a radical union agitator.
But they got along.
But they got along very well. They had a lifelong relationship and produced several children's books together. They worked on the WPA, created The Negro in Illinois, rewrote it and released They Seek a City, which they then rewrote again in the 1960s. They had a lifelong relationship, these two authors, one black, one white.
Let me bring in a caller now on line 4, Belden in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yeah, good morning. This is a fascinating program. I wanted to call about, there was a very racist time in Chicago during this period, and they were working kind of against the odds. I wonder, Brian, if you would say a bit more about the kind of political persecution, which of course would even intensify once J. Edgar Hoover took aim at the active African-American movement and the Communist Party and other people on the left and in union organization.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something I talk about more in my first book, The Black Cultural Front, the way in which black writers associated with the left in the 1930s, they were so often excluded, felt the brunt of oppression, economic deprivation in the 1930s, that they were swept up in these social and political movements, above and beyond their own will. They were swept up in these movements, and so they then continue to write, continue to publish, but then by the late 1940s and 50s, the McCarthyist movement catches up with them. So I think that's part of the reason why The Negro in Illinois was never published. It was shut it off to the archives, but, you know, things changed in the 1940s and 50s and made it even more difficult for a book like this to be published. Jack Conroy himself was blacklisted. He wrote encyclopedias for the rest of his life, encyclopedia entries. Now, for a guy who had written one of the best novels of the 30s, The Disinherited, published a second book, published three journals, and then to go on to write encyclopedia entries. You know, this was a sign of the times. Bontemps himself went down to Nashville, worked as a librarian, and largely raised his family through those years of the McCarthy period. But both these figures then later return in the 1960s and are working side by side with a new generation of writers, artists, activists in the 1960s. So they do survive, but it's important to note that there's a reason why these papers were shuttered away, and it's partly political. You know, there's a long neglect of black literature, black history, but this was a particularly a political period, and a lot of this memory of the Depression, as my grandpa called it, the Dirty 30s, has been shuttered away and neglected, and hopefully with this publication we're starting to bring some light to this period.
Belden, thank you very much for the call. I'm wondering, as the years went by for Bontemps and Conroy, did they continue to hold out hope that the Negro in Illinois would see the light of day, or did they just sort of leave it behind them as time passed?
Well, they recycled some of the material and used it, and always thought that there was something special about the project. And as much in the papers, as much as the other individuals they met, some of them went on to receive acclaim. Frank Yerby made $1 million. Nelson Algren, who worked on the WPA, although not on the Negro in Illinois, went on to publish a little book called The Man with the Golden Arm, which was turned into a movie.
Frank Sinatra.
Oh, right. Yes. And so Nelson Algren sort of cashed in at that moment in the 1950s. And I've seen letters between Bontemps and Conroy, and they'll say, you know, here's Nelson Algren's hit the big time. You know, maybe they see the golden apples are one day coming our way. So they had a belief that there was something unique about this project, that they met so many special people, and they thought that they were all talented individuals and all destined to go on to some higher fame. Some of them did. Catherine Dunham became a famous dancer, but a lot of them struggled for the rest of their life, just trying to eke out a living as a writer.
You mentioned some other names as among some of the participants, people like Margaret Walker, mm-hmm. Fenton Johnson. Richard Durham struck my mind because I know that he worked in radio.
Right, Richard Durham.
And I think particularly what I have heard, as a matter of fact, you can find it on YouTube now, some of his shows, and I believe the particular show he did really one
Destination
of the
Freedom, it was
that's
called.
That's the one.
1948 to 1950. And Richard Durham got his start on the WPA. And in addition to the Writers Project, there was a wing, a radio project, a radio division. And they produced several radio shows on the WPA in the 1930s, where Durham got his first start. And he met several other people on the WPA. They went on to work together to produce Destination Freedom. This was sponsored by the Chicago Defender, ran on WMAQ.
A little irony there. WMAQ, that's the station where Amos and Andy started.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And so they would have an hour of some comedic show dedicated, you know, by African Americans. But they would have an hour dedicated to gospel music. This was the era of Thomas Dorsey and Mahalia Jackson. But an hour dedicated to telling these stories from black history. This was quite unique for the time and a sign of these growing interests. But Richard Durham's another case in point. He goes on. His show is taken over. They sort of whitewash the show, turn into a show about white history and white heroes. He goes on, ends up suing the radio company and gets blacklisted. He sort of flounders around. He works for the Meatpackers Union in Chicago. Eventually, he goes on to work for Muhammad Speaks, the newspaper for the Nation of Islam. And he meets Muhammad Ali, and he publishes one of the first books of Muhammad Ali, Richard Durham does. There's soon to come out. I have a friend at Howard, Sonia Williams, who's soon to publish an entire book on Richard Durham, which I think is really going to be a breakthrough.
The Negro in Illinois is out now. And what is your hope for just the long-term impact of this book being out there?
Well, this is one of the primary documents from the period known as the Black Chicago Renaissance. And there's more and more scholarly works coming out from this period. There was an entire collection by Darlene Clark Hine, a Northwestern professor, that recently came out and is bringing more attention to this period. And we would hope that it would produce the same scholarly interest and familiarity in the general public with this period, what's a really rich, fascinating period when black and white workers were working side by side, collecting, producing knowledge of black history, black arts, black culture, and for a popular audience. Keep in mind, this is a book not for a scholarly audience. This is written for a public audience. This was written by, you know, and produced with public monies. There's no footnotes. You know, there's very little of the scholarly kind of things around this book. So it's something that was written for a public audience. I think it still is very readable and very enjoyable for a general public.
Now, you know, this is a tricky subject. Yeah, this is a book which enabled black writers to have a voice in black history. You're white. You're the person who brought this book essentially back to publication. What started your own personal interest in African American history?
Well, I always had a history in this period of the Depression. Again, this is my grandfather's era. He was a son of a coal miner in southeast Kansas. So I always was fascinated in this period. But then I was the child of the civil rights movement. While my parents didn't march in any marches by any means, you know, I was raised in that period when I grew up in integrated schools with black kids around. And so it was I was always interested in black people and black culture. And so this project was a way for me to sort of align my interests. And I very much think that black history is for white people. There's fascinating stories here.
Well, I'm glad to see The Negro in Illinois in print, and there's a lot more we could talk about concerning this book, but we are out of time. But you may want to get out to the Urbana Free Library this Saturday at 2 o'clock when Brian Dolinar will be speaking about The Negro in Illinois, the WPA papers. Brian Dolinar teaches history at the University of Illinois. His own website is briandolinar.com. We will have a link to that put up onto our website at will.illinois.edu. Brian, thank you very much for being on Focus today.
Thanks so much, Jim.
And thanks to everyone who called or emailed questions. Our apologies to anyone who didn't make it to the air. Focus was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. Ryan Weber is our intern. We'll be talking about lawn and garden care. Yes, even in this weather, we'll be talking about it tomorrow because we know eventually the spring will come. This is Focus on WILL.